Hello, on this week's program, Susan Lewis considers the variety in ballet today as Pennsylvania Ballet prepares to open a new program headlined by a work entitled Tango with Style. Jason Pfeiffer visits the Landis Valley Museum in Lancaster County. The Living History Village and Farm collects, preserves, and interprets the culture of the Pennsylvania German rural community from 1740 to 1940. And we listen again to a conversation with LA Times writer Steve Lopez. The movie adaptation of his best-selling book, The Soloist, has just been released to critical and popular acclaim. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
For Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Ballet is typically associated with classical music, perhaps because of its courtly European roots, and well-known works such as Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker and Swan Lake, and Stravinsky's Firebird and Rite of Spring. Yet as the art form has evolved, choreographers have explored other traditions, other music, even other dance styles. This week, tango-infused ballet joins a neoclassical work and a brand-new 21st century ballet. Now, WRTI's Susan Lewis considers Pennsylvania Ballet's latest potpourri.
Today, dance companies seem to sprout like wildflowers in Philadelphia. With so many different varieties, contemporary ballet, modern dance, avant-garde, and movement theater, what is the role of classical, or even neoclassical, ballet? Take, for example, Pennsylvania Ballet's new program featuring Tango with Style. If dances were climates, classical ballet might be cool, white, and snowy, like a Russian countryside. The tango? Hot, with bold colors, like a lush South American jungle. So what happens when you take the music of tango and create a ballet?
They create a very powerful mood on the stage.
Pennsylvania Ballet artistic director Roy Kaiser says mixing styles can be tricky.
And choreographers often have tried to either work with classical ballet vocabulary and have it influenced by other styles or types of movement, or to really try and fuse those different styles together, but they're not always successful. When it's done well, it's something I really like. Hans was really successful.
In 1977, Hans von Manen first created five tangos for the Dutch National Ballet. Maya Venema, who now teaches this work to ballet companies all over the world, was there at its creation and danced in the premiere.
He heard the music of Astor Piazzolla, and that was very new, very different from the tangos we knew before that. It's modern tango. It's not... You know, it's not one of those. They're much more romantic, in a way.
The dance he created, she says, is definitely ballet.
He didn't use, like, ballroom tango steps at all. I mean, it's on point. The girls are on point.
Ballet, but infused with the strong, sensual flavor of the tango.
They have black and red dresses on, and they have something in their hair. And in all of Hans von Manen's ballets, men and women are equal. And there's always a tension between them. And here, in the tangos, of course, also. So when they dance together, they also flirt. In some ballets, the girls are always very light and very sweet. They get lifted, and the men do all the work, and the girl just looks pretty. Hans doesn't like pretty very much. He likes strong. So women are as strong as the men.
Fast forward more than 30 years to the creation of a 21st century ballet to more traditional music. Women are also strong partners in Matthew Neenan's premiere called Keep, a dance for five couples set to the string quartets of Alexander Borodin and Rimsky-Korsakov. Although an abstract work, it is, says Neenan, about the way people connect or don't.
Just kind of the rocky road of a relationship, any relationship really. So there's a couple that's a little more melancholic, but then there's one couple that's just kind of spicy. And then there's another couple that there's an edge to them. And that's where the difficult partnering comes in. It shows that they're struggling with something.
Women are in dresses, men in slacks with vests.
I want them to look like themselves. I want them to look very real, very human. And trying to get them to use their personality more, like they're creating the dance while it's happening.
Instead of character or story guiding the movement, in this ballet, movement, inspired by music, creates character, one step at a time.
I usually like to throw out a lot of material and then go back and edit, kind of like a writer. You might say, like, that lift isn't working, we need to change it, or I'm going to do a little more choreography here, or I need to fix this section. But I think it's more important that you just get the material out for them so that they can get a taste of what the piece is going to be like, especially for stamina.
A ballet grows into being. In contrast to Nienen's exploration of the power of movement to express emotion, and von Manen's stylistic twist on tradition is a work set to the music of Felix Mendelssohn.
It's 15 minutes of pure, joyful movement that changes all the time.
Pennsylvania ballet master Jeffrey Gribler danced in the 1985 premiere of Robert Weiss's Octet for Strings.
It's about eight dancers dancing to eight strings. There's no story. It's just pure dancing. It's what I would call, for a dancer, a social ballet. It was always fun to dance. I like passing it on.
Great fun in high art? Ballet, says Gribler, doesn't have to be elite.
It's really just a different form of entertainment than a movie or a play or tap dancing.
Or tango. Roy Kaiser says flavoring ballet with different styles does more than broaden the perception of the art form.
It expands the individual dancer's vocabulary even. It really takes what they know and do to another level.
Even with its technical rigor and classical overtones, ballet is a very personal, very human expression, passed from choreographer to dancer, from one dancer to the next. Perhaps ballet's role is to protect tradition by both respecting its artistic foundation and translating it for the future.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Pennsylvania Ballet's new program, Tango with Style, opens Wednesday and runs through Sunday at the Merriam Theatre in Philadelphia.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
For many, visiting a history museum might mean wandering through quiet exhibit halls, peering through countless glass cases, and reading a multitude of labels with small print. But the Landes Valley Museum offers an exploration of living history, interpreting rural Pennsylvania life from centuries past. Now WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer takes us on a visit to a museum that aims to take an all-encompassing step back in time.
Just about 5 miles outside the city of Lancaster, the Landes Valley Museum is on a property of over 100 acres, surrounded by evidence of modern times. Cars driving by, planes flying overhead, people talking on cell phones. But there are also vivid reminders that only a century or so ago, life in rural Pennsylvania was radically different. With people dressed in 18th and 19th century garb, visitors might find a field being plowed with an ox, a leather worker making a pair of shoes, or a blacksmith shaping a horseshoe. Tim Essig, manager of interpretation at Landes Valley, says the museum's approach is based on a simple idea.
We remember what we experience more so than what we've read or heard.
With an operating farm and a village of period buildings, the Landes Valley Museum collects, preserves, and interprets the history and culture of Pennsylvania Germans from about 1740 to 1940. Essig says presenting living history allows people to experience the past.
It's a sensual type history, one that uses the senses. It's a glimpse, just that brief moment where you are living the 18th or 19th century.
Landes Valley was started by brothers Henry and George Landes. They wanted to explore the heritage and contributions of Pennsylvania German settlers to early American culture. Curator Bruce Bomberger says before founding the museum in their own home, the Landis brothers had a variety of careers, building the railroad out west, editing technical journals in New York, managing a sanitation department in Lancaster. They retired in 1924 and within a year opened their museum.
It was a very folksy type of museum where you could come in and sit down with either of the brothers and tell them what kinds of things you specifically wanted to see, and they get these things out and they let you handle them.
Though they had no formal training in museum work, Bomberger says the brothers were particularly interested in examining the history of technology and craft trades.
These two men were middle class, and so their collecting habits were set apart by the fact that they valued work and work skills and trade skills, and so they were very interested in tools and tool technology, and not only the objects themselves, but how people used them.
Just before the Landis brothers died in the mid-1950s, control of the museum was handed over to the Pennsylvania Historical and Museum Commission. But the original vision remained. The heritage of Pennsylvania Germans, the Pennsylvania Dutch, is deeply rooted in agriculture. They helped establish farming practices in the region, including crop rotation. And so a strong focus of the Landis Valley Museum is farm life. Joe Schott, the farm and garden manager, says there are two sites on the property representing techniques for raising crops and livestock from specific periods.
One is 1780 and the other one's about 1840 or 1850. And the animals are appropriate for each of those time periods. The horses are out here to the left, and this is the 1850 time period. The 1780 would have been oxen instead of horses. And we have chickens up here that are time appropriate, and sheep.
Schott says this living part of the museum helps show visitors that agriculture was central to early American life. And with nearly all the work done manually, it was a grueling lifestyle.
It was subsistence agriculture. So your whole life was just getting through to the next year.
The museum also has a variety of heirloom seed gardens, a program preserving plant breeds that grew in southeastern Pennsylvania before 1940. Visitors can dine in an old-style tavern that serves traditional Pennsylvania Dutch meals, browse through a replica 1900 country store, and watch demonstrations of spinning and weaving. The Landis brothers left a large collection, nearly 100,000 artifacts. A farm and machinery exhibit hall houses some of them. A rope machine, plows, tractors, a huge steam-powered thresher, a host of hand tools, and an authentic Conestoga wagon. This was an invention from German settlers in Lancaster and an important part of American history, according to Bruce Bomberger.
This is the vehicle that in the days before the canals and the railroad was designed to be a freight hauler. While some people did go west in them, these are the vehicles that took backcountry produce to the city, like Philadelphia, New York, Baltimore, and then headed back to the farms with products from the city.
And just as its Conestoga wagon facilitated American commerce and helped shape the development of a young country, Pennsylvania's rural culture deeply influenced the agrarian and small village life of early America. Whether it be through the demonstration of an old craft, getting a close look at a farm animal, eating a traditional meal, or strolling through an exhibit of farm artifacts, the Landis Valley Museum offers a glimpse into this Pennsylvania legacy, living examples of a bygone era.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The Landis Valley Museum in Lancaster is open year-round, and next weekend hosts its 23rd annual Herb and Garden Fair, benefiting the museum's heirloom seed project. In 2005, on a busy street corner in downtown L.A., former Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Steve Lopez heard a beautiful melody being drawn from a battered violin by a shabbily dressed homeless man. Nathaniel Ayers had once been a promising musician, studying bass at Juilliard. Now destitute and suffering with mental illness, he was living on the streets. What started off as a series of columns for the L.A. Times turned into a mission for Lopez, and he has, over the past 4 years, formed a close friendship with Ayers that has taken the musician off the streets and into a more stable existence. Steve Lopez tells this story in his book, The Soloist, which is this year's One Book, One Philadelphia, and now a very successful Hollywood movie starring Jamie Foxx as Nathaniel Ayers and Robert Downey Jr. as Lopez. We spoke with the author last year.
Downtown Los Angeles is a very busy place. It's thousands of people walking to and from work. And he did not appear to be playing for money. He didn't have the violin case open. He didn't have a hat out. He was just playing to play music. And I said, well, why do you pick this particular spot? And he pointed across the street and he said, there's the Beethoven statue. I play here for inspiration. And so then I knew I might have something, but it took several visits to figure out what this guy's story was. And with each visit, he warmed up to me a little more, and I was able to tug the story out of him. And the big break comes when he's scratching names on the sidewalk, and I ask him, who's Betty and Albert and Tom and, you know, Rebecca? And he said, those were my classmates at Juilliard. And I said, Nathaniel, you went to the Juilliard School for the Performing Arts? He said, oh, yeah, that was a while back. He said it quite nonchalantly, like it's no big deal to go to Juilliard. And I'm thinking, okay, we've got an African-American man, homeless, playing a violin, missing two strings, went to Juilliard. I think I've got a column.
Nathaniel, at this point, wouldn't have appeared to have been a very, shall we say, reliable source. How did you go about verifying this story?
Well, you know, I would ask Nathaniel on the street there, who can I talk to get the backstory on this? And how did you train in Cleveland? How did you become a musician? And he said, well, you know, I grew up it was kind of a tough neighborhood. His mother had a beauty salon. His dad was out of the picture. Mom had music on in the beauty salon. And Nathaniel just took to the music. He'd go there after school. The ladies are all having their hair done. And Nathaniel's enjoying the music. And his mother says, maybe you should take piano lessons. So he does a couple years of that and then goes to junior high band. And that's, you know, we're talking 60s when public schools in America had extensive arts programs. It was considered part of a well-rounded education and everybody was handed an instrument. And the arts were big. It was before we got into the three R's and not much else. So he had a natural thing for it. And his junior high band teacher had him playing several instruments, but nobody could play the bass. And Nathaniel was a strong kid, and they needed a rhythm section. And Nathaniel was pushed in the corner with the bass and became so good on it in such a hurry that his teacher, Mr. Moon, said, I can't help you. You're going to have to go to see this guy in the Cleveland Symphony. His name is Harry Barnoff. He's been in the orchestra forever, and he teaches some of my better students. And that became his tutor. So I'm on the street in downtown L.A., and I said, Nathaniel, who influenced you? And he said, oh, you can call Mr. Harry Barnoff in Cleveland. And I said, well, how do I get hold of him? And with an index finger, thin air, writes out his phone number. And I scribble it in my notebook. And I said, are you still in contact with him? He said, nope, I haven't talked to him in decades. So I'm calling the number thinking it can't be any good. And somebody picks up on the other end and says, Barnoff residence.
Wow.
So Harry Barnoff told me that Harry was in tears when I told him that his former student was playing a two-string violin in downtown Los Angeles living out of a shopping cart. And he said, that was one of the most promising students I ever had, and my heart is broken hearing this. He was such a great kid, and it was so tragic to see his crash.
People, we love a great story about redemption, and this really is just such a story, is it not?
This is, I think it's a story about second chances and human connections and the power of art and music. It has saved him. In his third year at Juilliard, he starts getting very confused and having trouble focus. And when you go through the transcripts, if he's having to sit in a classroom and study the history of music literature, his grades are falling. If he's in performance with the orchestra, he's getting A's. And the teacher comments are promising young talent, renew his scholarship, unlimited potential. Nobody knew that he was losing his mind. And Juilliard at the time, as far as I can gather, was not a welcoming place, and there was nobody there to pick up on little emotional problems or psychological problems. And there was one teacher there, a bass teacher by the name of Gary Carr, who went on to be the rare person with a solo career as a bassist, who saw that Nathaniel was having problems. And he told the administration, they said, no, he's just a troublemaker. And he said, no, he is losing his mind, which indeed he was. So he crashes, goes home to Cleveland. He's in and out of his mother's house. He's on the streets. He realizes he can't lug a bass around in a shopping cart. He saves up money working at Wendy's and shoveling snow, walks 15 miles, buys a violin, and has been trying to teach himself other instruments all these years later. So I meet him, and he's down and out. But, you know, this serendipitous encounter leads to what has been a really deep and meaningful three-year odyssey and one of the, you know, the most meaningful relationships and friendships in my life.
Steve Lopez, the soloist, is this year's One Book, One Philadelphia, and a movie based on the book starring Robert Downey Jr. as Lopez and Jamie Foxx as Nathaniel Ayers is now on release. And that's it for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.